now. Scotland's Talkin. Call 0333 20 20 401 and join the debate.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's Sunday, it's Scotland's Talkin. I'm Ali Bally. We're here together through until 12 midday. On the programme today, are you ready to go electric on the roads?
We have to get rid of petrol and diesel cars off our roads if we're going to make sure not only that we deal with the health problems that air pollution causes, but also that we meet our climate change targets.
Environment Secretary Michael Gove announced that petrol and diesel cars as we know them will be banned from 2040. The technology exists, but will the country be ready? Mike Hawes from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders has his doubts.
Not only is there insufficient charging infrastructure, but also if you look at the nature of the UK industry, it's built on the internal combustion engine.
Now, if you've already made the switch, tell me, how do you find getting around on battery power? Have you ever been stranded because you ran out of juice? Have you been on an electric car and decided, give me the petrol or diesel one back? Let me know. After 11, I'll be joined by Scotland's Minister for Social Security, Jean Freeman. She'll be taking any questions you've got about benefits or the plans to set up a new Scottish Social Security Agency. It'll cost £150 million a year to run and have up to 1,500 staff. I'd also like your thoughts on why Scots are getting fatter. Judy Murray says it starts with the way we're bringing up our children.
The things that are trendy for kids to play with have for some time been things where you sit down, watch a screen, and the only thing that gets exercised is your thumbs.
She says we need to be more active. Well, 3 years ago this weekend, it was the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, which was supposed to get us all playing sport. We've been back to the village where the athletes stayed and found it's been transformed from a showpiece into a dumping ground.
They've got a lovely wee lake and it's full of bikes, trampolines, balls, wood, rubbish that people's just thrown in.
So what's the legacy of Glasgow 2014? Join us on Scotland's Talkin'. Here's the number, 0333 20 20 401. Good morning. Creedence Clearwater Revival and Bad Moon Rising brings the time to exactly 10:15 Sunday morning, Scotland's Talkin'. I'm Ali. Good morning to you. So the first subject we want to talk about today is the internal combustion. Yeah, the engine, it's reaching the end of the road, so we would be told. The government announced on Wednesday that petrol and diesel engine cars, as we know them, will be banned from sale from the year 2040. Now, after that date, you'll only be allowed to buy a hybrid. That's one that's powered partly by an engine and partly by batteries, or a fully electric car. It's all part of a wider effort to clean up our air quality, so they say, which we're told is very bad and leading to 40,000 premature deaths a year. So are you ready to make the change? Or indeed, have you done so already? Do you worry about whether it's practical to have a car that can't travel so far before it runs out of juice? Is it practical, like whether you're always able to find somewhere to recharge? Does that put you off? Are they still too expensive? And if you currently have a diesel car, how do you feel about the prospect of more taxes coming down the road because you drive the most polluting kind of vehicles? I object to that. I do. I drive a diesel car. And I drive a diesel car, why? Because we were told by the powers that be only a few years ago that diesel cars were the best vehicles to buy. Now they're the work of the devil. Jinx. I mean, you know, who is supposed to believe? Does it really depend which government's in power? And with 20 years to come, you know, will it all change once Michael Gove has been and gone and the current cabinet? What do you think? Is it all a piece of nonsense or do you agree with the way it's happening? I mean, that is an amazing figure. 40,000 premature deaths a year. Now, I have to say, you know, because I am involved in a bit in motoring, I do a lot of motoring journalist stuff. I don't agree that these 40,000 deaths happen because of diesel fumes. But that's me. What about you? 0333 20 20 401 is the number. Roger Lawson joins me on the line at the moment, and Roger is with the Association of British Drivers. Roger, good morning.
Good morning. It's now the Alliance of British Drivers.
Oh, my apologies. The Alliance of British Drivers.
Rename.
Right, OK. Roger, Just picking on that one fact, it's one that has been played out in the news bulletins over the last few days, about 40,000 premature deaths a year. What is your organisation's thoughts on that one?
Well, I think if you look at the person who thought up that number, you know, who created that and promoted it, the organisations who've been pushing it, if you look at the science underneath, it's very dubious. Nobody's got a death certificate that says they were killed by atmospheric pollution from cars. The number, there may be some people who've had their life shortened, but the figures are very much smaller than 40,000, quite likely.
So the point I was making there, that I am a diesel driver because a few years ago we were told that's what we should be doing. How does your organisation take on that then? One minute we're being told one thing, the next we're told another.
Well, we agree with you that it's very prejudicial that the government pushed people to buy diesel cars because of the CO2 benefits. And now, in fact, manufacturers responded and started only producing diesel cars. If you wanted to buy a Jaguar, it was quite difficult to buy anything but a diesel vehicle. So, this was a big problem that has resulted in a lot of people buying diesel cars when they might have preferred a petrol car. In fact, that's my situation. You know, I own a diesel car now, when I would have preferred to have a petrol car, because you get a diesel turbo lag on diesels. So our view is that, you know, the government shouldn't penalise people for responding to what they wanted people to do.
You're right, that's what was put out, and it's quite amazing how we're both mirroring each other here, because I'm exactly the same situation. I'd always driven petrol, but went diesel because, you know, the manufacturers were putting in a huge amount of effort into making diesel cars the cleanest car. How do you think the manufacturers feel about this? I mean, they're making some reasonable noises, but underneath they might be saying, hang on a minute. What do you think they're thinking?
Well, I think they're probably very unhappy because they must have invested millions of pounds in developing diesel engines to do what the government wanted. Of course, they did. Some of them did actually cause the numbers to be fiddled, which I think they should pay for and correct, obviously. But other manufacturers did respond with a lot of expenditure.
So we're in the situation that Michael Gove has announced this, and he's given it, I think, a fairly short period to get there. It's only 20 years. Do you think that it will happen in 20 years, or do you think it will be scaled back?
I think it will happen because, I recently had a test drive of a Model S Tesla, and I can see that even now they're practical for a lot of people. So, in 20 years' time, when they become probably cheaper, better range, so people won't have to suffer this range anxiety, as they call it, I think in 20 years' time that they will be perfectly practical. That's not to say, though, that they will necessarily be environmentally better, because you've got the problem of producing the electricity and you've got the problem of manufacturing and then disposing of all these batteries with metal elements in them. So, you know, it's not quite as good a solution as the government's making out. But one can see in certain parts of the country, and I live in London, and clearly in central London, air pollution is not very good. Mm-hmm. You know, you can feel that it's a problem personally. So something needs to be done in certain localities about air pollution. Whether it makes financial sense to force everybody to buy an electric car, we would rather question that.
And will you continue monitoring it, your group continue monitoring the government's moves on this and take them to task?
We have made submissions, and in London, where the mayor has even more aggressive short-term policies, we've made submissions on that, and we'll continue to do so.
Roger, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning and giving us your group's views. Roger Lawson from the Alliance of British Drivers, thank you for that. Watch out, because you'll see a lot coming from them as they keep an eye on it, as many of the big motoring organisations are doing as well. But what is your view? If you have a view, then let me have it. And that number again is 0333 2020 401. 0333 2020 401. So say thank you very much indeed to Roger. I do say, you know, I wonder, are we going to have enough charging points throughout the country? There will be some of us, and I include myself in this. In 20 years' time, it's highly unlikely if I still will be driving. So, you know, it won't affect me. But it does concern me as to what we're doing for future generations. You know, yes, we're cleaning, according to many people, we're cleaning up the atmosphere. But the numbers that are thrown in there, I have to say, I'm like Roger, I question that. The 40,000 people have, according to some of the figures, the air quality, we're told, is very bad and leading up to 40,000 premature deaths per year. OK, your thoughts then? 0333 2020 401. This is Scotland's Talking. I believe Lynn's on the line. Lynn, good morning to you.
Hi.
Good morning. How are we?
Hi. I'm fine, thank you.
Good,
thank you.
Good. Now, Lynn, you drive. Do you still drive an electric car?
I still drive an electric car, yes.
Right, OK. So tell us, what made you change then?
Well, I suppose my main reason was because it's a company car. The tax benefits of the electric car is far greater than a petrol or diesel car. The benefit in kind for my previous car was about 27%, but the electric car 7%. So it was just, there was no, you know, it was an obvious decision that it was going to benefit me tax-wise. Plus the company got the plug-in grant, the $4,500 deduct off the price of the car before we even took out the showroom. So it was
right.
Worth doing for that reason.
Monetary-wise, it was worth doing?
Yes, absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
What car did you have before?
A Q3, an Audi Q3.
Right, an Audi Q3. So you went from an Audi Q3 to, was it the Nissan Leaf?
It is, yeah.
Okay. What's your thoughts on the drive? How did you cope, first of all, with the difference in the driving?
I couldn't actually really tell the difference. It actually really felt like I was still driving my Q3. It was unbelievably just so similar, so smooth, so... It's got a great takeoff. I couldn't fault the car at all.
Okay. And as far as mileage and how far you get on a charge, which is something that people keep bringing up?
Well, I tested it recently. I drove from Forfar to Aberdeen, took a bit of a detour to get back to Aberdeen, and I used about 73% of the battery charge. So you would definitely manage to get Aberdeen, Dundee.
Right.
On one charge.
Mm-hmm. And what happens if you want to go to Glasgow?
You have to plan to stop and recharge the car. You do have to plan your journeys.
Do you think at the moment, though, for you, Lynn, living in Aberdeen and maybe wanting to travel across Scotland, do you think there's enough charging points there for you?
Yes, there is. There's an app that tells you where they all are, so you'd have to plan your journey to stop at the various points to recharge your car.
Right.
Yeah. And there is quite a lot in Scotland. It's absolutely shocking. When I decided to look at it, I thought, well, you could actually drive to the very north, you know, north of Scotland and drive all the way around. There's so many rapid charge points.
So you have no regrets whatsoever?
No, not at all.
There you go then. we, you know, it's the questions that keep coming up that we're getting an answer from somebody who's actually doing it. Questions being, not enough charging points. Lynn says, yes, there are.
Yeah.
Totally different dynamics in driving. No, it's not.
No, it's not. You have to plan. You do have to plan. You can't rely on a petrol station be there. So you've got to know where the charge points are.
Right.
So yeah, you have to plan, and you have to plan your journey time. You can't say, I'm going to be an hour in Dundee. You might have to stop and charge. You might take 20 minutes off, you know, extra time to charge your car to get to Dundee. So you've got to plan all that.
Excellent. Right. Thank you very much indeed, Lynn. Lynn Durwood from Aberdeen with her thoughts on her electric car switching from petrol to electric. So thank you very much, Lynn. Your thoughts, 0333 2020 401. Back on the phone lines then, we are talking electric cars at the moment. Alistair Duke, how are you?
Not bad, thanks. How are you?
Very good, very good. Electric cars, are you in favour?
Very much so. I've actually driven one for the past 2 years. So I recommend them to a number of people. I've certainly had a number of people coming into my car as passengers, and then, you know, and then they say, well, maybe I'll buy an electric car for my next car.
Mm-hmm.
It's seems to be very popular.
When it came to the change, you're talking about 2 years ago, it was a fairly brave move to do that 2 years ago, Alistair. What made you decide to go for it?
A number of things. I definitely wanted to do my bit for the environment, but I think what I became aware that that there are a couple of cars on the market that don't cost too much. I mean, I paid £10,000 for mine. There were some cars on the market that don't cost too much, and in Scotland it's actually free to charge cars on the network currently in most parts of Scotland. I do a lot of miles for my work, so, you know, my employer actually pays me about £1,000 to £2,000 a year in travel expenses because I do a lot of driving and work.
Right.
And I thought, well, if I can charge my car free, then obviously that saves me a lot of money in petrol. So it actually made financial sense as well.
And again, like Lynn, who called in a few moments ago there, have you noticed, or did you notice initially any difference in the driving, you know, the feeling
of driving? It's actually more pleasant, to be honest. I mean, you know, all electric cars are pretty modern. You know, the gear stick cars I used to drive would have been, I had a 2005 Volkswagen Golf and a Ford Ka that was older than that. So, you know, so they were a bit rickety, to be honest, but it's a very smooth drive. I mean, it's obviously automatic. You know, they don't have a gearbox as such. There's a forward gear and a reverse gear, and that's about it. And, you know, actually I found it entirely pleasant, very smooth, a pleasure to drive. The only thing is obviously remembering to plan when you're going to be charging, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lynn was saying that as well. It's down to the planning, really.
It is, absolutely. You've got to be good with maps, and you've got to know how far you are from a charging point at any one time. But, you know, most of us don't drive long journeys that often. I mean, I'm based in Glasgow, so most of my journeys are around Glasgow, Paisley, Lanarkshire. And, you know, and I know the major charge points in those routes and how much battery I need to get to these places. And, you know, certainly if you're somebody that's got a driveway, then you can charge to your car to 100% every single night, you know, using the off-peak electricity supply.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you're driving out with about 80 miles range each morning, and that's just on the basic models. You know, there are more, these days there's cars coming on the market that will go 150 to 200 miles on a single charge, and you can do that overnight at your home. So actually, you know, it does save people a lot of money in petrol, and, you know, the quality of the drive is excellent. You know, the cars are very well made.
And have you ever been caught out with running out of charge?
The only time that happened was on the day I bought the car, believe it or not.
Don't tell me they gave it to you with not a full charge.
No, that wasn't the problem. I went down to England to buy the car because I was getting a bargain. I drive a Nissan Leaf, and I went, I think it was 2015, so I did a bit of research online, and I couldn't afford to buy a new one, which would have come in at about £18,000 or thereabouts. So I got a nearly new one for sort of £10,000, give or take. And but I had to. So I went through Nissan's website, and they said, "Well, we've got an ex showroom car, you know, that's been driven on test drives and so on, but that's not had an owner."
Mm-hmm.
And it was 2 years old, and it was a good price. So I went down to Derby to buy it, and I set off from Derby with 100% charge. Got to Ferry Bridge in Yorkshire, charged it there, which only takes about 20-25 minutes to charge at a service station, and then I set off, and I took a wrong turning. Coming out the services, and I drove in the wrong direction for 10 miles.
Oh.
And because of that, by the time I'd realised my mistake and come back on the road north towards Scotch Corner, I was cutting it fine in terms of getting there. And I think I was also driving a bit fast because I was so excited about having a new car. And I think because of that, the battery range dropped faster than expected. And so I basically had to limp into Scotch Corner services at about 30 or 40 miles an hour, because I knew that if I drove at you know, a normal speed,
yeah,
like 60 or 70, then I would have come a cropper.
So
I sort of dribbled into the service station, and the battery actually gave out on the roundabout just before the service station, so I had to get out and push the car the last 100 metres. And I was thinking to myself, God, this is the biggest mistake I've ever made. I've paid £10,000 for a car, and I've nearly ruined it on the first day. But no, it was absolutely fine. And You know, so I got a flight on day one.
I was going to say, that would be it forever then. I mean, you would just say to yourself, I'm never going to let the charge get that low again.
Yes, I promise myself I'll never be so silly again. So nowadays what I do is I make sure I've always got a minimum of 10 to 20% battery at the end of the journey. So I never shave it too close to zero. And, you know, as long as you plan, I mean, if I was to drive my car carefully from 100% charge, I could probably get about 90, 95 miles out of it. But, of course, I know not to do that, so I probably plan to stop every 70 to 75 miles if I'm doing a long trip.
Alistair, thank you very much indeed for giving us your thoughts on it. Thanks for that. So there you are. There's another electric car driver who says, yeah, great. Ian Hutchison, hi, Ian.
Hi, Ali. We're interested in your topic this morning, I've got to admit. And I'll go with you, Ali, buying a diesel car. I was told 50 years ago that diesel was the fuel of the future, which I thought was a great theme or a great tag. And I did the same as you. Just a few things, Ali. LPG was a thing that they were trying to push for quite a time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing that, I mean, I don't think there was the same amount of emissions for that. But that was mainly for petrol, but they also did it for diesel, but they said they were pushing more as far as the petrol was concerned. The other thing I was going to say is, in your MOT, catalytic converter, mainly for diesels as well, you wouldn't get past an MOT unless you had that. The other thing, just what the gentleman was saying near the pushing up the Scotch Corner to have to go to another point again. Ali, at the moment, you get them for nothing because it's all to do with publicity and just trying to push and get all these kind of things all out the way. Wait a minute. It'll no be, Ali, you get nothing for nothing.
Well,
ever.
There's a good point here being made on Twitter by Craig. Craig says, does this mean there will be no fuel tax duties at the pump because we won't need petrol and diesel pumps? So, if we were to totally do away with or try... if they say they're going to ban these cars in 20 years, then in 50 years there'll be no need for fuel stations as we know them at the moment. So therefore, I would think that if they're going to lose the money on the tax fuel duty, then they will have to get it clawed back from somewhere else.
Definitely, Ali. Definitely.
So,
Ali, I'm very much in the. I'm very much involved in motorcycle sport, and I go to the Isle of Man TT every year.
Right.
And this is one of the races as part of the programme, is the electric bike race.
Okay.
Electric motorcycle race. Now,
mm-hmm.
These have got big, huge batteries. And the technology that I've got in motorcycles for this particular race, Honda are up there, but a lot of the manufacturers from over the world, because the TT is the shop window as far as motorcycles are concerned, I like it, they can do one lap of the TT course, which is just about 40 miles, but that's all they can do. You're very, very limited to anything like that. Also, Ali, as far as noise is concerned, well, okay, I'm not saying noise is a pollution problem, but I mean, okay then, if just say cars or motorbikes, whatever, coming down the road and here's an old biddy walking across the road with her messages, she can't hear anything coming along. You can hear a lorry, a bus, a car or whatever, and you'll stand by the roadside. When it's as quiet as that, I'm not saying you're going to go back to waving a red flag to the front of the vehicle, which was done many, many years ago. Ali, what's another thing as well is, I work for a big, Scotland's biggest dealership, driving semi-automatic cars, was cars with an engine, cars with a battery.
Mm-hmm.
Behind the back seat was a huge big battery. When the battery went down, then the engine kicked in and charged up the battery again. Another thing I was going to say, Alice, was even putting solar panels on the roof of a car so that as it's going, it's
recharging.
It's charging all the time.
Yeah. But is it not like, and you'll remember this, I don't because
I'm too
young. But, you know, we go back to the days of the electric milk floats. I mean, it's basically the same thing.
I had one in Pennycook, I can mind it fine.
I remember being told that you were the first driver. Thank you very much indeed, Ian. Let's go to Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Ali. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
I just said you're headed into Troon Beach. It seems to be the place for a party just now, Ali.
I didn't get my invite. I don't go where I'm not invited. Right, what's your point?
I've listened to all these people with the batteries and electric cars. Most of your callers, like myself, we'll not need to worry about it in 40 years' time. The thing is, technology's moving, Ali. And you're correct what you're saying. Go way back to the 50s and the early 60s, there's electric milk floats. We've been doing that, though, Ali. It's been tried and tested. Have you got in one of these cars today? You need to be like the Ant Hill mob with a top cap, because if it does, you can't get to your destination. You need all these passengers to push it.
But you've just heard from two people who have these cars who say you can get to your destination.
You can't.
Hold on, Ali.
You get detours, roadworks, crashes, there's all sorts of things in there, Ali. And these things, they take time. You might get a rapid one, you get in there, but if there's somebody in there before you, you're beat. You need to stay in a hotel. It's nonsense, but what I like to say is, see all these fancy vintage cars that people have bought and have kept through their family? Are they going to be devalued?
Mm. Well, that's my concern about my diesel car. Of course, it's coming up to this year. I should be changing it if I was going to change. But, you know, if it's diesel, am I going to lose a lot of money?
And the thing is, folk actually buy these vintage cars. I mean, you've got Chris Evans, there's loads of them in these big estates. There are thousands of these cars, and they're worth billions. What happens to these cars?
I think they will become more valuable rather than devalued.
Where do you get the fuel for them, Ali?
That's a very good point, Stephen. I bet, yes, it's unusual for you to make a good point, but we'll leave you on that one. Thank you. Back on the phone lines, and we have Alec McKechnie in Dumfries. Hello, Alec. How are you this morning?
Fine, thanks.
Good. What's your point?
Well, my point is that there's a few things that have never been mentioned by anybody that's pushing these electric vehicles that it's severely concerning. The first thing is that if they do get the amount of electric vehicles they want on the road, as in the hundreds of thousands, where's going to be the infrastructure for charging them? And then the electric that you're charging your vehicle up with, it has to be generated somewhere. So there's going to be pollution somewhere along the line. Also, end of life of these vehicles, the batteries that are in them, apart from all the toxins and stuff that are produced in some of the third world countries, and other big countries where the batteries are produced, when they come to the end of their life, it's very difficult to get rid of them with the materials that's in them and the toxins that's in them. So the environmental thing for me, at the end of the life of the vehicle and while you're running the vehicle, they don't balance out against any other form of transport that they have at the moment.
So the main problems, as far as you're concerned, is it just totally environmental then?
They're pushing it in environmental, Ali. Mm-hmm. They're pushing it on life saved and quality of life of individuals living in big built-up areas. At the end of the day, you're just going to move the problem somewhere else where you dispose of these things. At the moment, I've got a mate that deals with car salvage, and when a damaged vehicle comes up for sale at an auction, all the guys that deal in damaged vehicles shy away from these. They'll not touch them, because then they're responsible for the batteries. They're responsible for the parts that are in them that nobody wants to take, that nobody wants to salvage. And they're not a viable thing after a period of time or when they've been damaged. Mm-hmm. And if we get hundreds of thousands of these things in the road, you're going to multiply that by the amount of vehicles that you've got in the road. You're causing another issue on an environmental front. You're causing the issue with mere pollution with the electricity that you're having to generate to charge these vehicles. And also, the infrastructure, I know people are going to say it's not all albedded and all the rest of it, but at the moment, the people that are buying these electric vehicles, they're getting big benefits. They're getting free charging. There is, in the cities, charging points. I live rurally. At the moment, it wouldn't be any good to me whatsoever. I couldn't charge it up. I couldn't go any distance. Mm-hmm. If you get stuck behind other vehicles and things, you know, there's a breakdown, as your other guy said, you can't take an alternative route, you could be stuck. At the moment, it's not feasible, but for me, the biggest worry is that nobody's talking about what happens to them at the end of their life, or if hundreds of thousands of them appear on the road and they need charged up, because at the end of the day, they're electric, they're going to need charged.
I remember sort of 3 years ago, maybe more than that, when councils jumped on the bandwagon and a few councils bought a few of these, you know, and I did make the inquiry, have the council bought them or have they leased them? And they said, oh, we bought them because we've got a great deal. And my question back to them was, well, who's going to buy them when you're finished with them?
Oh, yeah, I mean,
how are you going to get any of your money back here?
It's it's a fair point, Ali. It's the same your previous caller as well said about other things that the government have pushed. They pushed the LPG years and years ago. I had a few LPG cars. Aye, it was half the price of petrol. It was great. You got tax, road tax benefits. You got cheaper road tax for larger engine vehicles. Then they phased it out. The prices came up. It's about three quarters the price of petrol. You don't get any tax benefits. There's only certain facilities that can fit it and service it, and there's not so many of them left now. Now it's jumped on. As you said, everybody was encouraged for diesels. I've got two diesels sitting in the drive. I've got a diesel motorhome that I couldn't take into the English cities at the moment because it's no Euro 5 compliant. Scotland's probably going to go the same way. So, you know, you're going to be victimised for where you can go and what you can use it for because of the alleged pollutants. But if you buy an electric car, you can go where you want, if you can charge it up, if you can get there. But there's no looking at the end of life cycle or what's going to happen with the electricity generation to charge your vehicle. It just seems to me that they just seem to jump in with 2 feet all the time. And it's, I know they'll say that they've researched it and all the rest of it, but there is a research out there as regards end of life of the batteries and such like. And as I say, I've got a mate that works with salvage and they'll not touch them.
And I just wonder what happens sometime in the next 20-year period where we get another new government in who have a different view. And then they, like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown telling us to change to diesel cars. And now it's changed again. It's you and I, it's the drivers, it's Joe Public that are left to pick up the bills here.
It's just the same, Ali. With the best will in the world, I can't see it being any different with electric. In fact, I can see it being fully worse, as I say, because of some of the materials that are used in their construction. Yeah. At the moment, as I say, it's a non-starter for me. I live in a rural area, and it just the guy that said he broke down on the way to Scottish Corner and had to push it in. It could be that there's a lot more accidents if you're driving along, suddenly somebody slows down in front of you, somebody stops altogether because they've run out of charge.
That's right, just stops,
It's good luck to them that have got them, and if they're getting the benefits, financial benefits now, but I think it'll come back to bite them in the backside, but there you go.
Alec, thank you very much indeed. Alec McKechnie in Dumfries. Let's go to John Carr, who's in Glasgow. John, good morning.
Good morning, Ali. How are you, my friend?
Fine, thank you very much indeed. Right, your thoughts?
Well, I just see, as a taxi driver, I spend a lot of money on fuel a week, and I cannot foresee me, well, it's not going to happen with me, but in the future, driving about in an electric car, and every 2 or 3 hours, having to pull out to the side of the road and sit for 20 minutes, charging up my battery so that I can go on my merry way working again. It's going to put about 4 hours on in my working day. What happens, Ali, when you're sitting and if there was a traffic jam? Not that that happens in this country, you understand, but if there was a traffic jam, I mean, are you going to have to sit there and turn it off and but stop, start?
Are you not, though? Could you not be accused of just looking at the negative side of it, John? I'm thinking of a complete taxi fleet in Dundee, which is electric. And you don't see, in fact, they're so popular now that initially the taxi drivers, and you can imagine they were for it because they weren't getting charged anything for electricity. They now are. They pay £2 per charge, which is a heck of a lot cheaper, obviously, than a car going for petrol or diesel. But they're doing it. They're doing their 8-hour shifts. And, so are you just looking at the negative side here?
No, well, I'm always looking at the big picture, Ali. Now, I reckon what's going to happen is that just now you'll get it free. I reckon in the future what they'll do is they'll say you can buy the car, but you lease the battery.
Right.
That's what I think they'll do. You'll lease the battery and you'll pay for a lease for the battery.
Which wouldn't be a bad thing because you would just hand the battery back at the end of the lease and get a new one.
Uh-huh. But how much is it going to cost you? Now, what happened to the C9? That was electric. That was the big, new, fancy thing. 10 minutes it lasted and then disappeared.
Well, it's like the LPG, as we were talking about earlier. LPG was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Yes, and not only that, Ali, but what happens in 20 years' time when they say, right, there are no more petrol or diesel cars, that's it, it's done, it's dusted, no more, none. What happens to the poor guys, the unfortunate guys, the working class guys who are still working, knocking about in the older cars? Are they just left to go on with it?
Well, it would become harder and harder to get diesel and petrol, wouldn't it?
Yes, of course it would, because these, as you so rightly said, the petrol stations are going to be a thing of the past. The Chancellor's 67 pence in the pound is going to be a thing of the past, so he's going to be wanting his cut somewhere else as well. And they always keep hammering on this thing about, oh, it's pollution and it's bad for your health. The government have known for years that it's been bad for your health. Never done nothing about it. They knew that asbestos was bad for their health. Never done nothing about it. So, well, I mean, I'm very critical, Ali, because I just have no faith in the government. I just think they play things to suit themselves. And we're all supposed to sit back and say, oh, that's a great idea, we'll just go with that.
John, I'm going to have to leave it there because of time getting up to the news, but thank you very much indeed for your call. We'll take more of your calls and talk about Social Security and benefits. Have you got problems with benefits or anything like that? Well, the minister responsible, or will be responsible fairly shortly when it becomes devolved to Scotland, is joining me now in the studio. We'll chat to her in a few seconds. Music and conversation for a Sunday morning. This is Scotland's Talkin'. I'm Ali Bally. It's 11:10, and joining me now is the Minister, Scotland's Minister for Social Security, Jean Freeman. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you this morning then?
I'm grand. It was good. A lovely drive through here this
good.
Morning.
Good, good. We organised the weather for you.
Thank
then.
You. I appreciate
That's...
it.
Now then, let's get us started by the last time you were here, it was the bill was going through the changing of who's responsible for what. Bring us up to date. Where are you?
So where we are now is we now have put draft legislation into the Scottish Parliament, which we need to do to give us the legal powers in Scotland to use public money, in effect. So that will go through the Parliament over the next year. Once that is passed by Parliament, then we'll have the power to start delivering on the 11 benefits that we're going to be responsible for. And we've said already that we're going to start between summer 2018 and summer 2019. We will pay the increase in carers allowance to bring it up to the level of job seekers allowance, which we've committed to. We will introduce our new Best Start grant, which replaces currently the Sure Start grant for pregnant mums.
Right.
Only our changes will more than double the payment for the first child, and will introduce or reintroduce payments for the second and subsequent children, which the UK government have taken away. And we'll also take over responsibility for funeral payments, which assist people in certain groups, low-income families, to bury a loved one.
Right.
And then after we've done those, we then move to the next set of benefits. I think you'll remember last time I was on, I talked about the importance of doing this in a staged, planned way, mm-hmm. because it affects overall 1.4 million people. We don't have a social security system and agency in Scotland for Scotland, so we have to build it from scratch. So the other stage we're at now is we've made some decisions about what that will look like. We've said that our social security agency will have a local presence in every local authority in Scotland. So someone that you can go and meet face to face, a human being who will help you work out what you're eligible for, will help you with the form that you have to fill in, and won't make the decision, mm-hmm. But will help you with everything you need to do to get your application in for the benefit you're entitled to. We've said too that in terms of the medical assessments for disability benefits, that we are not going to use the private sector, simply because I don't see how trying to make a profit, which is legitimate in the private sector, squares with a public service that is determined to present dignity and respect as a kind of core element of it. And the final, I guess the final, I think, exciting thing we've done, Ali, is that we have recruited 2,400 individuals who have experience of the benefit system to work with us, to help us design and test ours. So we're really building it from the ground up.
And when you were here the last time, you were really looking for the public to get involved, and you were very much saying, look, tell us what you want. Yeah. Let's look at this and see, we've got an opportunity to start something afresh, and let's get everybody in on it.
Yeah.
Have the public come forward?
Yes, they have. Yes, they have. Not only the organisations that are experienced, like Citizens Advice Bureau, but also others who are specific perhaps to disability or to particular condition, or one parent families for that Best Start grant. But those 2,400 individuals are volunteers, and they cover every local authority in Scotland. And they're just ordinary members of the public who have trusted us enough that we really do want to hear what they've got to say, to volunteer their time to tell us, one, their experience of the current system, what works, what they think needs to be changed. But then they're actually going to be involved in helping us test our ideas to make sure that what we're doing works. And that, because do you know what it's like? Sometimes you can have what you think is a bright idea. And if you just go ahead with it and the people that it's going to affect don't get any input to it until it's done and dusted, that's when you find that your bright idea wasn't that bright at all. You need those folk involved at the outset to say, OK, Jean, there's a bit of this that's quite good, but actually some of it won't work. But if you change it this way or that way, then it will. That's what they're going to help us do.
Right. The Social Security Bill, as we say, is introduced. It's on the way. The bill would give the Scottish Government powers to top up reserve benefits and, as we've talked about, create new ones in developed areas as well. One question that has already come in, will you meet calls to top up child benefits by £5 a week? Is a straight question, I suppose.
Yeah, there are a number of legitimate and perfectly reasonable issues that have been raised with us about increasing the level of financial support that people already get for reserved benefits. One of them is topping up childcare, child benefits. Another is helping to mitigate the impact on people of the UK government's benefit cap, which is causing serious hardship for people. Our Scottish Welfare Fund, which we use to try and mitigate the worst effects of the impact of UK government benefit changes, it shows in the last year that 10% of the applications for crisis payments, which is when people are in desperate states, they have no money at all.
When they're in a crisis.
They're in a crisis. That comes as a consequence of the benefit cap. So we have lots of legitimate pressures on us. We are looking at all of them as carefully as we can. It's a difficult choice to make between one group of people as opposed to another group of people. And it is a difficult choice in the overall Scottish budget, because anything that we pay in addition in terms of benefits, of course, has to be money that comes from another area of Scottish government spend. So I can't say that we will do that. Equally, I'm not willing to rule it out completely. All I can say to people is, you know, I completely understand why they're asking for this, and we have to make some very difficult choices and decisions, and government is looking at that.
Okay, this morning in our news, Scottish Labour are calling for the rollout of universal credit to be halted. Alex Rowley has written to various people, including Ruth Davison. And the universal credit coming from Westminster, I know, but Scottish Labour are saying, let's stop this at the moment. What's your reaction to that call?
Well, I'm really pleased that they're supporting what the Scottish Government wrote to the UK Government and asked for repeatedly. Angela Constance, the Cabinet Secretary, wrote to the UK Government some time ago saying, could you please halt the rollout of Universal Credit to fix the problems that we see arising now before you carry on. Now, we see any of your listeners in East Lothian or in Highland or in other parts of Scotland who are experiencing the full rollout of Universal Credit will see the problems that it's causing in terms of, one, there is a six-week delay before an individual receives their first payment. Now, that's a long time to go without any money at all. And we don't see why it needs to be 6 weeks. Secondly, there are glitches and problems in the system itself. That's causing rent arrears for social landlords and private landlords, which, of course, affects their capacity to invest in their business and build the more social homes that we need in Scotland, and a number of others. And those problems are well documented, both from Citizens Advice Bureau in Scotland and in England, and from local authorities. So what we've said to the UK government is, you know, it's just sensible. If you're introducing a new system, and in your first wave of introduction, as I said earlier, despite your best ideas and your best intent, it goes wrong, the sensible thing to do is not to carry on regardless and impose those mistakes and problems on everybody, but to pause it, fix it, and then carry on. So we've been saying that repeatedly. Labour now supporting that position. That's great. I know that COSLA also have that view, as our local authorities in Scotland. And collectively, we should now put aside any differences we might have on other things and begin to put real pressure on the UK government to do that and bring all our Scottish MPs down in Westminster. We've got a whole new batch of them, different political parties. Put aside those differences and support what we're saying here to just halt the rollout, fix the problems, and then you can get back on track.
OK, well, we'll probably come back to that in the next 10 minutes or so. But let's go on the phone lines and have a chat to Flora, who's on the line. Flora, hi, good morning to you.
Good morning, hello, hi.
Hello there, you're through. What's your point, please?
Hi, I'm a Canadian who's been living in Glasgow very happily for the last 8 years. And my question is obviously based on my experience comparing the benefit system in Canada to the benefit system here. And the question that I have is, do the governments here compare successful benefit programs that happen in other countries and use that as some sort of a basis to roll out potential new benefit options going forward in the future here? Is there that type of study and comparison done here?
Hi, Flora.
Hi.
I can't speak for the UK government, but in the work that we're doing in Scotland to set up the social security system here for the 11 benefits we'll be responsible for, we have looked internationally to see what other systems are doing. But as importantly, we have put together a group of people chaired by a guy called Jim McCormack, who is associate director with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, with long experience in this area, and a number of others with expertise from academia, economists, and people with particular experience of the current benefit system from the point of view of disabled people and others. And part of their job is partly, first of all, to advise me and help me in setting up the system right now, but also to look wider in that international context, along with the analysts and researchers inside Scottish Government, to see how going forward we can improve on the benefits that we will take responsibility for. So our first job is to set up our system and take over that responsibility, make some changes we've already decided on, but going forward to then look at how we can improve on those benefits. And in doing that, we are absolutely cognizant of the importance of looking outside of our own shores and seeing what ideas exist elsewhere in the world that we could use or adapt for use here.
Okay. Flora, does that answer your question?
Yes, yes. I guess what I was specifically speaking was regarding the benefit program for unemployment, as well as the benefits for people under substance abuse. So, and also benefits for women and abused women and single families. So, is there anything in the pipeline in regards to those specific benefits of any sort of unique or out of the box thinking of what we currently have?
Well, the first thing I have to say, Flora, is that we in Scotland won't take as a government responsibility for any benefits that relate to employment. So those will stay with the UK government. So we don't have the opportunity to make changes there.
Okay.
But in terms of your point about the specific circumstances of women who have suffered domestic violence or people with addiction problems and so on, we do have the opportunity under a UK government benefit called Universal Credit to make some changes within that benefit, although the overall one will stay with the UK government. And one of those changes that we're looking at is, at the moment, if you Universal Credit is paid one payment to a household, and a number of organisations, Women's Aid and Engender and others in Scotland, have made the point to us about creating the opportunity to split that payment, particularly for women in circumstances where they are in an abusive household. So we're looking actively at how we might do that. We need to reach agreement with the UK government because it's their benefit we want to make a change to, but we're busy trying to work out how we might be able to do that.
OK, Flora, thank you very much indeed. Let's squeeze Craig in here. Hello, Craig.
Hi, how are you doing, Ali? Hi, Marlon, June.
Morning.
Basically, I want to talk about the Scottish Welfare Fund, especially in Glasgow. I think it's been a total disaster since it was introduced. I think it's because it's a local authority that's in charge of it. I've made numerous claims on behalf of others to this organisation, and the aggression you're met with on the phone, I mean, it's worse than the old DHSS. It's actually worse, and I think it must be patchy throughout the country. So what we've basically got at the moment, when it comes to a crisis, you've got a patchy service, depending on who you get on the end of that phone. It could be a total hit or a miss. And it's like they're deliberately, they don't want you to claim this money, and they're also giving you like goods instead of like cash. So they'll give you goods. But these goods, some of these goods, you're not going to refuse them because you're suffering from chronic poverty, but at the end of the day, you're getting beds that are falling apart, carpets that wear out within weeks. Do you know what I mean? And I bet you're paying a fortune for them.
Mm. Jean?
Well, Craig, good morning to you.
That is
a real worry, what you're saying to me, because there shouldn't be... First of all, there shouldn't be an attitude on the part of anyone administering a fund on behalf of the Scottish Government that is aggressive or negative. You know, yeah. I'm really keen that our social security system founds itself on the
dignity
basis that people,
respect,
absolutely,
Jean,
that people who come to it do so because they're entitled to that support.
They're most vulnerable. Chronic poverty, it's a terrible disease. It really is. And people are so ashamed,
well,
you know.
And then
they make it worse.
Yeah, yeah. Right. No, I absolutely understand that. Craig, can I make a suggestion to you? If Ali's people here would pass on to you my email, could you just drop me a line and give me some more detail about your experience? And I undertake to have a real proper look into that and talk with colleagues in Glasgow's local authority and see what's
that.
Going on. No problem at all. Please do.
Something that's been bothering me for a long time, you know. It was just
right.
Great to get the opportunity.
Well,
yeah.
there's your opportunity now to get directly in touch with Jean and let us know how it goes as well. Thank you very much indeed, Craig. Hang on there. We've got your number, actually, Craig, so we'll get back to you after the show with Jean's email address. Right, so this is Scotland's Talking. I'll be back in a moment. Sunday morning, Scotland's Talking, music and conversation. We're talking at the moment with Jean Freeman, who's Scotland's Minister for Social Security. Let's go to Gillian, who's on the line. Gillian, hello. Good morning to you. You're through to Jean. What's your point, please?
Good morning, Ali. Morning, Jean.
Morning.
Yes. I've had 6 fractures because I've got osteoporosis, and the job that I've been in for 45 years, I'm 60 tomorrow, and I left school at 15, and I've been in the caring profession for 45 years. I've never been in benefits in my life, and I got a phone. I'm on PIP, personal independence payment, which I get £55.20 a week. Then I got a phone call. I had to go for various health assessments, and they gave me, it's on a point system, and each time I have had no points. So I got a phone call from, I was on the ESA, and I got a phone call from them and said, you've got no points from the health assessment, so we're taking you off that. So I have to live off £55.20 a week, and I'm now getting behind with my bills. I've been to the Citizens Advice Bureau, and I've had to put a mandatory reconsideration in, which I've not had. It was only during the week I went, so I've not had that back to see if I can get back on the ESA. And as I said to you, I don't know nothing about benefits, but I don't know what this universal credit is. I think it means that I have to go and look for a job. Now, I can't sit for 40 minutes, and I've got to get up and exercise my muscles. And since the first time when I applied for ESA, I've just recently fractured my hip. So I can't work. I don't know what kind of job Gillian, they want me to do.
Right, Gillian, just stop there for a second and let Jean come in on this, because Jean, you know, you would think this is, you know, Gillian here is the type of person that we should be helping.
Oh, absolutely, we should. And so, hello, Gillian.
Hello.
And thanks for phoning in and telling us a bit about your current situation. You know, the current benefits that you're on are administered by the UK government. So you qualify for PIP, but you've been taken off ESA. Now, ESA will stay with the UK government, but actually, it doesn't make any sense to me that that you get PIP, which you're entitled to and you qualify for, but ESA, which is very similar, except it's employment focused, but it also involves that health assessment that you described about your state of health and its impact on you, that they've taken that off you. I can't think of a better place that you've gone to be honest, for advice in the current situation than Citizens Advice Bureau. They're quite right to suggest that you, in effect, appeal against the decision to take you off ESA, which is what mandatory reconsideration is. And even if they turn that down, you still have the right to appeal to a tribunal. And I know that Citizens Advice Bureau are well able and well experienced to help you do that. And I'd urge you to do that. I absolutely appreciate, though, that these things take time, and in the meantime, you're left with only the PIP money. And I genuinely wish I could fix it, but at the moment, A, I'll never be able to fix employment support allowance unless the Scottish Government is given those powers by the UK Government, and we're not yet ready to take over personal independence payment. But even if we were, you would still, to some extent, be in the situation you currently are in, where you've got two benefits administered by two different governments with two very different approaches to it. So please do stick with Citizens Advice Bureau and take their help and advice in appealing that decision on employment support allowance, because it from what you've told me, it makes no sense to me.
Right. In the system that's coming in under the Scottish Government then, will people still be sanctioned or indeed put through health assessments under the Scottish regime?
Well, first of all, there will be no sanctions.
Right.
We absolutely do not believe in sanctions. The UK government say that their sanctions regime is an incentive to people to look for work. There is no evidence to support that. And what there is a lot of evidence is to support the fact that sanctions simply place more people into poverty and hardship. So we won't have sanctions. But what we will do is look at, and I'm absolutely convinced that we can do this. Part of the reason why there are so many health assessments demanded by the UK government is because, first of all, the application form for the benefit itself is long, complicated, and asks questions that aren't clear to people what evidence they need to provide to support their application. So we can change that. We can fix that. Secondly, I think the starting place for deciding what is your condition and how does that affect you is the individual's own story, what they tell you. And you then look for supporting evidence to that, which would be from healthcare to confirm perhaps the diagnosis, but also from social care or other parts of the health service to confirm what support and help the individual needs. I think if you can get all of that information at the start, then you can make the right decision at the start without needing an individual to have to go for a health assessment. Where we do need to have health assessments, though, we are determined that the people who will be doing the assessment will have experience of the condition that they're assessing. One of the biggest problems with the current system at the minute, Ali, is that where people have fluctuating conditions, and there are lots of them where, you know, today might be a good day, but tomorrow won't be. Tomorrow you won't be able to walk so well, if at all. Or you have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. So today you can get up, you can get out, you can cope with it all, but tomorrow not. The current system, that points-based system and that health assessment system, can't cope with that. So if you turn up for your assessment, having made loads of effort to get ready, you know, get your hair done, put your makeup on, somehow you are penalised for that. Now, I just think that's nonsense. So our health assessments will be run by health professionals. We will have fewer of them, and we won't run this arbitrary system that can't cope with the reality of living with a debilitating health condition or a disability, which is that the impact of it on you changes not only from day to day, but sometimes within one day.
Okay, Gillian, we hope you get that sorted out and take the advice there of the minister and do get into citizen advice and get the appeal underway. Let's go to Norman, who's in Aberdeen. Norman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ellie. Good morning. I would like to ask Jean. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the SNP are trying to make Scotland once again the land of milk and honey. They're trying to make everything so different from the rest of the UK. Where's all this money going to come from? Do you know what would be far better? If we just had one government and we didn't have to pay all these Scottish ministers fortunes in salaries and have to pay for the Holyrood Parliament. We should only have it. We're the United Kingdom of Great Britain. Why do the Scottish Government and the SNP in particular want to make everything so different in Scotland? Is this another ploy?
Hang on. You've asked the question three times, so give Jean a chance to answer.
Good morning, Norman.
Good morning.
Can I just, if you forgive me for one wee second, can I just say to Gillian, if she's still listening, a very happy birthday for tomorrow. I think Gillian, our previous caller, told us that she was going to be 60 tomorrow.
Oh, right, she did, yes.
So, Norman, you and I are not going to agree on this.
Never.
No, I didn't think we were. I don't think, two things, though, I'd say, is I don't think that the Scottish Government, either this current one or the Labour and Lib Dem one that was there before the SNP government, are desperately trying, just for the sake of it, to make Scotland different. But, you know, the argument that came that had huge support across Scotland in the referendum in 97, 98, and then created the Scottish Parliament, had huge support from voters, ordinary people across Scotland, was that there were some things in Scotland where the best solutions could be devised in this country itself. remembering too that we've always had a separate education system in Scotland, a separate legal system, even before devolution. So, you know, there is a nuance across the United Kingdom. There are different parts of the United Kingdom that face different challenges and different problems. And bringing government closer to people in those areas, which is in part what devolution is about, makes sense to me, because you should be able then to understand what those differences are and devise solutions that best meet them closer to home rather than hundreds of miles away. And the final point I'd say is, you know, I would love Scotland to be a land of milk and honey, but, you know, I'm 63 years old now and I'm a realist, and we're not going to get there, but we can make the country better. And the money that we will use is money that taxpayers and others in Scotland contribute to the Treasury, that comes into Scotland for us to use in the best way that the elected Scottish government and the elected Scottish Parliament, elected by people in Scotland, decide is the best thing to do. And if people don't like that, then come the next election, you've got the solution in your own hands.
There you are. Thank you very much indeed, Jean, and to Norman. I want to go to Sandra, who's in Fife, and we'll do that next. Sandra is in Kirkcaldy. Sandra, good morning to you.
Hi. You just have to bear with me because I've got a terrible sore throat.
Have you? Right. OK, yeah. We're listening to your throaty voice. It sounds good on the radio, Sandra.
Yeah,
I have to say.
Very husky.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll borrow it for a while. Uh-huh. Right, you're through to Jean. Give us your point, please.
Jean, I was involved with you last year in the Inclusion Scotland debate. It was an event about disabled people and how they were being treated and how the process could be changed.
Yeah.
Now, I was diagnosed with a disability in 1996, and I went for an assessment last February with ATOS, it was him, and I was refused. I didn't get any points. And then I'd done your mandatory reconsideration. I have a diploma in law, which is helpful to mm-hmm. be quite challenging about these systems. And I got my benefit reinstated. So anyway, to cut a long story short, my condition's worsened, and you have to duly send in notification if you get any worse. I'm now part of the inquiry for the Lady Smith Children and Care Abuse Inquiry. So I started to suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. I had to fill another one of these 64-page forms in that actually triggered me, and then I had to go for another assessment to Dunfermline, which is a business centre, I have to say, a dual-role building, a business centre. I had to pay for a taxi there out of my own money. The day I arrived there 2 weeks ago, my condition, I vomit every day. Like you said in a previous call, people can have a multitude of conditions. So I vomit every day, and it's partly a stomach operation I've had that went wrong. Anyway, when I got there, I was too unwell to proceed with the consultation. Now, I couldn't get into the toilet. There was one disabled toilet because it's a dual-row building. It wasn't fit for purpose. You know, there was many disabled people waiting to be assessed, and it was a council building. So I had to vomit in a public arena in the waiting area and eat little doggy bags, sick bags, because they could not provide me with a disposable bowl to do this in a dignified and respectful way. Now, my daughter recorded the whole thing, and I had to sit there for an hour. And then when I left there, I was told by the receptionist that I'd get a home visit. Now, Pip phoned me and says that wasn't going to happen. And I says, is this call being recorded? Because I was told, and it's been recorded, and because it was in a public arena, we hadn't even got into consultation. And they says, no, we don't record our calls. So what chance in a fair process under Article 6 of the Human Rights Act, and I'm not being quite legal, has people got that people are telling you one thing is going to happen, these buildings aren't fit for purpose, these consultant people aren't half the time health trained, and they can't even provide somebody who's got a medical condition to be dignified and respectful and throw away sick bowl. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be humiliating. I have to go for another assessment, and I'm going to challenge that. I'm not going to these buildings. I'm sorry, it's really, really disrespectful, you know, to be treating people like this, you know.
And right, let Jean answer then, because I know you got quite a bit you want to say there, but hearing that.
Yeah, Sandra, hello, and thank you for being involved last year. and for coming on again this morning. I mean, there isn't a single thing that you've said that I don't find quite appalling, and there isn't anything you've said about how it is disrespectful and it does undermine an individual's just basic human rights that I don't disagree with. So all I can say is that I can say a couple of things about what our system will be like. Can I start with mandatory reconsideration? Because what that actually involves in the current UK system is that effectively, if we imagined it, that I had made the decision about your entitlement to benefit and you ask for a mandatory reconsideration, then effectively what happens is I just pass all my paperwork over to Ali and he kind of checks my paperwork. He checks my homework, if you like. And there is a significant percentage of mandatory reconsiderations that uphold the first decision. And then when people go to appeal, the appeal is upheld. In other words, the early decisions were wrong. What we will do is not mandatory reconsideration, but mandatory redetermination. So if you appealed against the decision I made, then that would then go to Ali, who would start from scratch. He wouldn't look at what I'd done. He'd look at what you'd sent in, and he'd make his own mind up about what he thought should happen. If he happens to agree with me, then you can, of course, appeal. We've promised that our appeals will be quicker, but also we've promised that we will, because I think you need fewer face-to-face assessments, then I think that we will be able to do, and we've committed to doing, more home-based assessments. Yeah. Because in circumstances like your own, and for others, you know, I don't know if you saw, there was a recent story in the press about an individual, a lady who had to, the building she went to for her assessment was so unfit for purpose that there was no access if you had any kind of mobility problem. And she had to basically crawl up the steps to get in. Now, I'm not prepared in Scotland, in our system, for people to be put through that basic humiliation and indignity. And so we will conduct any assessments that we do have to conduct in premises that are already accessible to the public, like healthcare premises or local authority premises, and we will use healthcare professionals to conduct those assessments. Now, at the minute, I absolutely appreciate, Sandra, that none of that solves it for you right now. But I do think in terms of challenging your right to a home visit, that aside from what you obviously are experienced and know, you might want to contact your local MSP to help you with that as well. I know of other circumstances where that involvement has secured a home visit. So that might be something that's worth thinking about doing.
Okay, Sandra, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Hopefully you take that advice. I just want to get John Sinclair in. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're through to Jean, if you can be fairly brief, please.
Oh, good morning, Jean.
Morning.
I have a quick question for you. Now that the Scottish Parliament has the powers to help, what direct financial assistance is it going to deliver for women affected by the increase in the state pension age?
Right, John, I'm glad you raised this because, of course, there's some of this running this morning in the press. We have a problem with delivering assistance in terms of what are known as the WASPI women, of whom, actually, as it happens, I'm one. And the problem is this. First of all, I don't accept that the state pension is a benefit. I do think it is a contract that all of us have paid the Treasury, and it's a bit like having a private pension. You'd be a bit scunnered having paid into your private pension if they suddenly decide that you're not going to get it the year that you expected it when you first took out the contract. But there is a number of parts of the Scotland Act which prevent us from being able to either provide short-term support to those women or to introduce a benefit ourselves by reason of age, specifically prohibited under the Scotland Act, or to top up a reserved benefit when, in fact, these women, the problem that exists for us as WASPI women, is that we are not currently getting the pension that we are entitled to.
Jean, can I just get in there very quickly, because we should be going to the news now. So I just want to, this was something that was raised last week, and thank you, John, for raising it again. It was raised in the last week when we were talking about pensions, and it was said that the Scottish Government do have the powers to intervene. Are you now saying that you don't accept that you have the power to help the so-called WASPI women to create a new benefit to make up for the money they've missed out on?
I'm saying that we can't use the Scotland Act in the way that I've just described. We do have powers to create a new benefit. The problem we would have is that we can't create a new benefit on the grounds of age. And if we created a new benefit solely for women, then we'd have a problem in terms of equality legislation. So there are issues around that. But there is a fundamental issue here, Ali, and that is, for how long is the Scottish Government going to be expected to find the funds to pay for the faults and the mistakes that a UK government has made, having taken money off those of us in that category of WASPI women over the years through our national insurance and otherwise, and not now being prepared to return that to us in a state pension, which we are entitled to?
Jean, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll run out of time once again. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme today. And thank you very much indeed for your calls. We were going to also introduce and talk about obesity. Maybe we'll leave that for another week.